Welcome back to another episode of the Chaos Ball Podcast. Thanks for tapping in. Week late. I got sick last week. I'm still a little bit sick, but I feel much, much better. And my recording times are a little off this week. I promised an episode last week, didn't deliver. So two episodes this week. Today's, we're looking at the offense. Yeah, we're talking about Mariners. I'm not talking about the playoffs. I don't care. That's not true. I've been greatly enjoying the playoffs. Been super fun. Go listen to another podcast if you want to hear playoff takes, because that's what every other baseball podcast is doing right now. Not me. I have delved into the spreadsheets. I've internalized what happened to the Seattle Mariners in the year 2024. And I have things to say. I have plenty of stuff to say. Today is, again, as I said, the offense. I'm taking a look at the offense as a whole a little bit, and then focusing in on the position players, who was basically the good and the bad of the offense with a little bit in between, but there wasn't a whole lot in between with this offense this year, to be quite honest. And then later this week, hopefully Friday, if not Friday, then Saturday, we are looking at the pitchers, and that is all the pitchers, starting and bullpen, and then the podcast after that, which TBD date for that one at the moment. I will be looking at the minor leagues. And that one might be a little bit beefier than just going over the standouts of the system this year. I might actually be looking forward to next year, because they did hang on to basically all of their top prospects this season. They've shipped a couple out, like a couple top 15 guys out at the deadline this year, but largely most of these guys that were on the list at the start of the year are still on the list, plus some draftees that will be making the list next season. And there's more and more prospect stuff happening. There's fall league going on. Colt Emerson is absolutely destroying Arizona Fall League right now, but we'll get into that later. Today is for the offense. Today is an ode to what an offense it was, a year that the front office, their focus was to cut down on strikeouts, and that means nothing. That never really meant anything. That was just, I felt like they identified that was a pain point for the fans. I don't think they're stupid. Obviously, they knew the offense wasn't good and the strikeouts were bad. But as I said, all 2023, there is more to being a bad offense than just striking out a lot. Aaron Judge strikes out a decent amount. Mike Trout, when he plays baseball in the last 7 years, strikes out a good amount. But they're both elite hitters for a reason. And this team had so many more problems with strikeouts, but the strikeouts were the boogeyman. And they get rid of Eugenio Suarez. They get rid of Teoscar Hernandez. Both of them have phenomenal 2024s. Makes it look so much worse. But then at the end of the year, they looked like a contending baseball team. They really looked like a serious baseball team, which was hilarious. They go all season for 4 months and some change as just absolute shite from an offensive perspective. It was like some different players, but same story as 2023. Like Julio was not looking good, similar to 2023. Biggest difference was just JP was non-existent for a lot of this year at the plate and on the IL. But largely, it just looked like the same picture. And then the trade deadline happened. The Scott Service firing or dismissal and Edgar promotion and Dan Wilson promotion happened. And then, bam, they look like genuinely they were a great offense. Small sample, small-ish sample. But they looked like a really good offense for most of the second half, and they were a good team for most of the second half. And that's what made it funny, is because all of us saw this coming, whether you openly admitted to it or it was probably in the back of your mind, that this team was going to make a run and get close but miss the playoffs. And they did exactly that while looking like a pretty competent team at the plate for the last like 6 weeks of the season. So that was like, it's encouraging, I guess, because a lot of these players are going to be here next year, but that's a whole new season. Like, can they just, will they ever have a good offensive month of April or May? and that some of that revolves around Julio, some of it doesn't. But let's really get into it. I'm going to talk about holistically what the offense looked like, and then start with the best players and talk about them. I have a lot to say about the best players on this offense, and I am putting them at the front of this episode because I tend to just go on and on. And that just means there's less time to talk about the bad players, and that's okay. I have a lot more fun stuff to talk about, the actual good contributors to the offense. But as a whole, how did the Seattle Mariners offense stack up to the rest of the league over the entire 2024 season? Before even like looking at numbers at all, like, you know, it wasn't good. Like you did, like I just said, they were pretty bad for most of the year. Not the only reason they missed the playoffs, but definitely the main contributing factor. There's a lot of stupid reasons a team might make or miss the playoffs in this sport that we love. But sometimes it's easy to point to the biggest problem on the field, eye test, and then look at the numbers, and it just backs it up. This team was not a good offense. Just no good. I think I mentioned, I absolutely mentioned in the offseason leading up to spring training that DePoto and company just did not do nearly enough to strengthen the already weak offense we saw in 2023. And that's even though I thought the Polanco and Garver acquisitions were good, and we'll get to them. I thought those were good acquisitions, and I still was wanting another bat or two. And that kind of, like, if they traded for Randy before the season, that would have kind of fulfilled what I wanted. And even that probably might not have made them a good offense for a lot of this year. But, I mean, it was just going to be a lot of reliance on Julio to make the offense purr this year. I was worried about that. Just because we've seen him not perform, and then also simultaneously seen him have like a 6-week stretch of being the best hitter in baseball. Like we've seen the lows, we've seen the highs so far in his very young career. And lo and behold, Julio did not have a good April through June, and the offense around him was not particularly good either. And so the overall output was in the dumpster. It was really bad. I think the biggest failure of the season, and I was worried about Mitch Haniger, but both Mitches were the biggest failure of their season. Particularly, Mitch Haniger and Mitch Garver combined for 853 plate appearances this year. I'll get into their overall numbers at the latter portion of this podcast, but you know that that's bad. That's really bad. Going into the season, would have been happy with like 500 from Mitch Garver, even 600. That would have told me full-time DH. He was healthy, which was the main concern, and that was it. But Mitch Haniger, I was so worried about Mitch Haniger and the fact that he looked like he was going to be a fixture of the lineup for this team, and he was, and he wasn't good. And it's just, I'm not trying to like toot my own horn. Like, I think a lot of people were worried about that. And it wasn't surprising that he ended up being bad. It just wasn't surprising at all. He was awful for the Giants and hurt. And I think I basically said, I don't think he's going to be bad. He had like a 67 OPS plus or something last season. I think I said it wouldn't be that bad. But still below average, and that's kind of where he was. So I think giving 853 plate appearances to both Mitches after what we saw from them this year is just that's one of maybe the biggest contributing factor to this offense being shitty. But I digress. They ended up with a team WRC plus of 104, which is so crazy that we ended up getting there after most of the season that we watched. Team WRC plus is not like my favorite metric for overall team performance, and definitely I preach look at as many stats as you can. Not the only stat you should look at for team performance, but decent indicator. I mean, 104 has them tied with 10th overall in Major League Baseball with the Brewers and the Red Sox, and like I said, they were basically a top three offense in baseball for the last 6 weeks of the season, so I think those numbers are doing a lot of heavy lifting for that overall number. But just in a vacuum, if you look at that, it's like, wow. If they were the 10th overall MLB offense in terms of WRC plus all season with the pitching staff that they had, they'd probably potentially still be playing baseball at the moment as the championship series are going on. They ended up hitting .224 as a team, which was second worst. That also, I think, was one of the, that the batting average and strikeouts, I think, is the one that really gets fans going. I mean, hitting and not striking out is a good thing. Don't get me wrong. You can just still be good offense without doing that. But I think for like more casual fans, they care a lot more about batting average and strikeouts, and I don't blame them. I don't blame them at all. I don't blame anyone for how you were a fan of the team or what you care about. They didn't really address that. They were second worst in Major League Baseball, that average. They had a .311 on-base percentage as a team, which was just right in the middle, smack dab in the middle of the league, and then a .376 slugging percentage, sixth worst in Major League Baseball. That is the number that's not tolerable. If you're going to hit close to the Mendoza line as a team, you need to just have more extra base hits to justify the average. Because the OBP was fine. Like, the walks and getting on base has never really been the issue with this team in the past few years. It's the slugging and just the overall hitting in general that, like, the bat-to-ball stuff is just not ideal. But they get on base. I mean, Mitch Garver... still, he's like, that's his biggest strength. He's still good at getting on base. JP still, through his struggles, got on base. A lot of guys raised their walk rates a little bit this year too on the team, so that was never really the issue. And then all the, like I said, all the hand wringing about cutting strikeouts in the offseason, they ended up striking out 26.8% of the time, tied for the highest percentage in the league with the Colorado Rockies. And that number, the 26.8, is 0.9% higher than last season. So they ended up striking out more than last season after the offense offseason of cutting the strikeouts, controlling the zone. And like I said, they walked a lot, 9.4%. That's a good walk rate as a team. That was fourth highest in Major League Baseball. That's a really good walk rate for an entire Major League Baseball team. That is good. The problem is they needed to just hit those guys home more. That was also one of the biggest issues. You know what is interesting when I was looking at these numbers? They hit the ball really hard. Not really hard. They hit the ball hard. Pretty consistently. 31.9% hard hit rate as a team. Ninth highest in Major League Baseball. They led the league in fly ball rate at 41.1%. Going off only those two metrics and nothing else, you could easily think that they hit a lot of home runs. Maybe a lot of extra base hits. They had a really high slugging percentage despite their poor average. The problem is that to hit a home run, you have to hit the ball in play and just have enough power to do that, and they just didn't do either of those things. Despite the hard hit numbers, they still managed to not have good offense. I've talked about this before too. Fly balls turn into outs a lot more than ground balls and line drives. And then you factor in that they play 81 games in Seattle every season, and that will absolutely knock down your fair share of fly balls. It's not the worst home run park in the world, but it's not a good hitting environment, as we all know. Like, you get the picture I'm painting, why the hard hit rate and the fly ball percentage didn't yield more extra base hits. They scored 4.17 runs per game, 20th in Major League Baseball, and their record in their games where they scored more than four runs was 70-15. That is an 82% winning percentage when they score four or more runs. Their record when they scored three or less was 15-62. That is a 19 winning percentage. Oh, God. That is the backbreaker. The thing I'll remember most about this team is how elite they were, even when they score three or more, but four or more, 82% win percentage. That's insane. And like the best, like the competent MLB teams this season scored 4.5 runs per game, 4.6. So, yeah. But as I said, post deadline, and more specifically, the post Scott Service firing and Dan Wilson and Edgar Martinez hiring, from August to the end of the season, they had a team WRC plus of 114. That was the fourth highest in baseball. And they slashed over that same period. Oh, actually, just in the second half as a whole, they slashed 236, 331, 389. is a much better looking slash line as a team. Now that's the real bump here was the post Dan and Edgar taking over. Obviously it's the smallest sample of everything here. And this was like late August that they took over. But after that, they had a team WRC plus of 125 and they slashed 255, 347, 417 as a team with Dan Wilson and Edgar Martinez at the helm. I think the biggest indicator that something clearly changed was the walk and strikeout numbers. They had a 10.4% walk rate, which was slightly higher, like 1% higher than their season walk rate overall. So not like a huge change there, but that's good regardless. They didn't go down. And a 23.7% K percentage. They struck out 3% less as a team after Edgar Martinez was promoted to the hitting coach and Jared DeHart was let go. And that's more or less like a league average strikeout number for a team, which is exactly if that was like that all year, again, they might be playing right now. Like you didn't need those numbers to tell you that. It was, if you watch the offense struggle all season, like the improvement was so noticeable after the deadline acquisitions and then after Dan and Edgar were brought on. It was even more noticeable after that. They started putting the ball in play more. A lot more hits went up the middle. Like it looked like Edgar Martinez was coaching them to hit. A guy who knows a thing or two about hitting baseballs. They looked more relaxed at the play, a lot more like inside out swings. Like taking ball up the middle, taking ball the other way. Sacrifice flies were abundant in that 5-week stretch. Like they had almost as many sacrifice flies in the 5-week stretch with Edgar as hitting coach as they did all year. I think they had like 14 in those 5 weeks and like 18 before that the whole year. Like the situational hitting didn't make me want to claw my eyes out, which was a change from what it had been all year. Just, yeah. So overall, weird offensive year. Overall, not good. Not good at all. But like most of this team will be back next year. At least most of the team that was hitting in those 5 weeks with Edgar Martinez. Dan Wilson obviously will be back next year. DePoto said they're going to do everything they can to keep Edgar. And I'm inclined. He likes this job and will stay on. I freaking hope he stays on. With the exception of, like, potentially Polanco and his option not getting picked up. And then Justin Turner's a free agent. Maybe they re-sign him. Maybe they don't. Most of the guys are back next year. With, like, a hopefully healthy J.P. Crawford going into the year. And better than he was this year. That is encouraging for the offense. I think there is a higher benchmark that we're going to expect based on what we saw in those 5 weeks. Again, small sample, but they also were playing meaningful baseball, and they were playing against teams who were also, for the most part, playing meaningful baseball. I mean, they played like the Rangers a few times, which they weren't. But overall, like they looked like a pretty competent team at the plate. And I think I'll talk about what they might do in the offseason at a different podcast, but no matter what they do, I think they should enter next season in a better spot than they did entering this season because Randy Rosarena is on the team and Victor Robles, I can't believe I'm saying that, is on the team going into next year. And maybe he doesn't light the world on fire as he did this year too much, but he looks so much better. So Randy is really kind of the tipping point here. And then the big question mark is like, can Julio actually put together a decent month of April or May ball? We'll see. We'll see. But enough about the whole team. I'm going to start with the good players, talk about them for a little bit, and work our way down. I have a lot more fun talking about the good parts. So that's why I'm starting with that. Who else? Who else will we start with? Besides Caleb John Raleigh. Shout out to that middle name. That's a good, strong middle name. Kyle Raleigh. What a year. Genuinely. I could just leave it at that. But I have so much more to tell you about Kyle Raleigh. But holy shit, dude. Genuinely, I don't know. He's rocketed up my board of all-time Mariners already. He's amazing. I think for my money, he was the best catcher in baseball this year. is his fourth year in the bigs, his third full season, and he put up his best season to date. Like I said, I think he is the best catcher in baseball. He just got nominated as a finals for the Gold Glove, and his offense was better than we've ever seen it. He played the most games in his career this year, and leadership-wise, off the field, it felt like he said everything right in interviews. Just, oh God, what a year. Offensively, not quite as great as William Contreras. If we're comparing him to the, and I'm going to compare him mostly to the other catchers in the league, this position especially, I think is super important to not necessarily compare to the league as a whole. You can, I will a little bit, but I'm mainly going to compare him to other catchers. And William Contreras definitely had a better offensive year and is probably taking Will Smith's mantle of being the best offensive catcher in baseball. But defensively, Cal Raleigh is better than Contreras. Contreras' framing came a long way this year with the Brewers, but Cal Raleigh is just better than him defensively, more well-rounded. And Cal probably has the case. He has a great case for second best full-time defensive catcher in baseball behind Patrick Bailey. And I don't think it's like super far away. Offensively, defensively, he was the Mariners' best position player, and it genuinely was not close. Like he broke that record for the most home runs by a catcher in their first four seasons in MLB. And considering he only played 47 games in his first season, that's damn impressive. It's one of those stats that like is so cherry picked, but it's also just cool. And why it's cool is because it was Mike Piazza's record. Who, you know, before my time, but I think Mike Piazza was a decent ball player, if I do say so myself. So that was cool. Broke a record this year. He played 153 games, as I mentioned, the most he's ever played in his career so far. 135 starts at catcher, which is also the most in his career, and then 18 at DH this year. He set career highs in home runs. 34 RBIs with 100 stolen bases with 6, and walk percentage 9.6, all career highs. He continued the clutch narrative that just surrounded him coming into the year. I mean, he'll be enshrined in Mariners history forever, especially with this generation like of fans, which is basically me, with the breaking the drought dinger in 2022. And then I didn't bring any win probability added stats in here, but he had damn good win probability added stats in high leverage situations this year. And he had plenty of clutch moments again this season. And he's been doing it his whole career. And now, compared to catchers, among qualified catchers in Major League Baseball this season, he led all catchers in home runs. He was second in RBIs. He was third in runs scored. His 117 WRC plus was tied for second overall. His 5.4 F4 was tied for the most with William Contreras. And his F4 was 13th in all of baseball. And his baseball reference war was 4.6. And that was tied for 25th in baseball. He became the seventh catcher in MLB history to have a 30 home run, 5 stolen base season. What's also fun is he hit 13 from the right side of the plate this year and 21 from the left. Prior to this season, only 7 of his career of his 59 career home runs. So let me just say that again because I kind of fucked that up. Prior to 2024, he had 59 career home runs. 7 of those came from the right side of the plate, and he hit 13 this year. So he essentially doubled his career tally as a right-handed batter in 2024 alone for home runs. That's awesome. That's like just a cool, that's just like, I love watching a switch hitter just socking dingers from both sides of the plate, and he's a catcher. Like, that is badass. Talked about the stat earlier, but most home runs for a catcher in their first four seasons. And like, I stat-headed a lot of Cal Raleigh stuff just for this podcast and just out of curiosity. And all of these fun stats are pretty cool on their own. But when you read the names that like surround Cal Raleigh in all of these stats, you just realize how special of a player that he is and that the Mariners have on their hands. And the fact that he came through the system is awesome. Like the, just some of the names I've seen, Mike Piazza, like Carlton Fisk, Pudge Rodriguez, Johnny Bench, Roy Campanella, all of those names I've seen around Cal when I've been digging around on Stathead. And those are, I mean, there's more, but those are like, if you went up to a baseball historian and was like, who are the best catchers in all of baseball? All of those guys would come up, among some others probably. But all those guys are like the best of the best that we've ever seen at the catcher position. And Kyle is putting his name on these stats next to them. It's amazing. And just to keep going, I'm not done here. In FanGraphs, they have their WAR calculation is next to two other numbers. They're simply called offense and defense, which is basically their best approximation at determining like a player's overall value on both offense and defense, zero being average. Cal's offense number was 9.7, which was third among catchers behind William Contreras and Yiner Diaz. But his 21.8 defense number was number one, and it was not close at all. Tyler Stevenson is second with 8. Some of that is like games played, like you get more value the more games you play, obviously. But he was a workhorse and really good behind the plate. All the offensive output, impressive enough. Like I could stop here. But coupled with the defense that he played, just special. A special season from a special player. According to StatCast, he was second in catcher framing runs with 13. And that was behind only Patrick Bailey with 16. He was tied for second with 20 caught stealing this year. I led the league last year and was still quite good this year. Some of that is credit to the pitchers. These pitchers are pretty quick to the plate, which really helps him as well. But he also just, and he doesn't have the most elite pop time, which is just time from when he catches the ball to when it reaches second base. He's not particularly elite in that category, but he is accurate as hell. Like he put those, most of the balls he throws a second just on like a perfect spot where JP or the second baseman doesn't really have to move very much. They don't have to move their glove. It just kind of leads them right into the runner. That was something. He's also second behind Bailey in FanGraphs in their FanGraphs framing number. Second behind Bailey in defensive run save. Like Patrick Bailey's a generational defender, but can't touch Cal on offense. But Cal's right there. Like I said, I think he's the second best defensive catcher in ball behind Patrick Bailey. And he caught the best pitching staff in baseball this year. That there's something in that. He was banged up constantly. It felt like he took so many blows this year. It's hard to overstate just how good he was and how much the team needs to extend him and make him a career Mariner. Like he just needs to be a career Mariner. It just needs to be a thing that happens, for everyone involved. Like not only for the good stuff on the field, but the leadership he's shown, like he should have that C on his chest. Like his leadership felt like this year blossomed more than we've seen in recent years. Not like he was saying the right things consistently in interviews, like I said. And if the team is not only like, you can look past the production on the field that has merited him an extension alone, the stuff he's done on the field so far in his career. But if you're just looking at the general optics behind this situation and how the fan base feels about the team right now, they need to extend this guy. They need to do everything they can to extend him. I think that gets a lot of the stuff out of the way because then you can tackle the extensions, potential extensions for all of the pitchers, all four of them that you've homegrown that are, you know, then it's coming up soon to talk about that stuff. But Cal, I think, needs to be the first one. I need to stop talking about him. I have other players to talk about. He was just far and away the most important and the best player on this team this year. I enjoyed watching the hell out of him, and I will hopefully for the rest of his career in a Mariners jersey, but we'll see. But salute to Cal Raleigh, and we'll get to the next player on the list going down the FanGraphs WAR leaderboards. And that player is, you could guess it, Julio Rodriguez. you know, again, just looking at his counting stats for the year does not paint the picture of the season he had at all. Much like last season, very similar. Another pretty weird year for him. The fan base really turned on him for a good portion of this year, I felt like. He did more or less, like I've said, the same thing he did in 2023. Super tepid April through June, was basically hovering between slightly below league average to league average hitter at the plate. And then from July on, he was very, very good. From July until the end of the year, he put up the 11th best WRC plus in ball with 158. That's 58% better than league average for those of you counting at home. Funny enough, he was right behind Eugenio Suarez from July on in WRC plus, and right in front of teammate Victor Robles, who we'll get to. That's basically what he did last year. I mean, it's kind of remarkable that he basically did the same thing, just different circumstances this year. The problem with this, despite decent numbers at the end of the year, decent, is what I mentioned earlier. The team needed him to be great from opening day till the end of the season. They needed him to be consistent all year, and he simply just was not that. It was one of my gripes with the team building. As talented as we can see that this dude is, and like we've seen what he's capable of on the diamond, the team was constructed in a way that was just banking on him being a 6-7 win, even a freaking 8-win player, like MVP candidate this season in his age 23 year. And he has that potential. It's not like he can't do that. And the expectations, he set them his rookie year. Like, it's his own fault that his expectations are so high. I mean, we've seen what he can do. It's just so much to ask of a player that young and so risky, because this stuff can happen. Like, that's why the greats are great. That's why the elites are elite. Like, that's why Mike Trout is insane for what he did for basically a decade straight. Consistently, every year, he never really had a drop-off. He just got better at stuff every year. So, I mean, he should be the best player on this team. He should be the best hitter on this team. He wasn't this year. He absolutely deserves criticism for how bad he was at the start of the season. You get the thing on the internet where if you don't criticize him, or if you just say, hey, he's not the biggest problem with this team, it's like, oh, so he's perfect? No. No, no. He deserves criticism. Just entirely, like, the offensive pitfalls wasn't on him. A lot of it falls on his shoulders, unfairly so. Like, it sounded like he really didn't vibe with Brant Brown, like, at all. And clearly, DeHart wasn't really getting to him much either. Edgar, however, maybe unlocked him. Less so that, more so I think he just made him go up there with no thoughts and just focus on putting a good swing on the ball. You know, like, a lot of hard hits, pulled fly balls in the month of September under Edgar. I feel like Edgar and Dan, and it was communicated like this. A lot of the communication, it felt like the hitting coaches were over-communicating to these guys. A lot of it just felt like, hey, you're Julio Rodriguez, you know? Like, just go up there and hit. Like, I think that's all it takes sometimes, especially in the sport of baseball. It's so mental. It's so reliant on luck. He was pressing so much of this year. Like, you could see, for as much as fans are frustrated about his output at the start of this season and it was so poor, he is the most frustrated of anyone involved in this. Like, I'm sure the front office was frustrated that he wasn't lighting the world on fire. I think Julio is the number one guy who's probably the hardest on himself. And you could tell. You could really tell. He should always be playing with a big fat smile on his face. He should always be laughing. I hate the people who say that if you're struggling or your team isn't playing well, that you should be all serious all the time. No, you shouldn't be. You should stick to who you are. And Julio plays the game in a very fun way. He's a very jovial person. And some of that was taken from him at the start of this season. You could tell he was pressing at the plate. He looked visibly frustrated a lot of the time, and it was frustrating for everyone involved. But his numbers overall, like, are solid for the whole season. Like, they're fine. He ended up slashing .273, .325, .409, 143 games, 613 play appearances, like, essentially a full season, with a little bit of injury time in there. But 143 games in 2024 is a full season of ball. I'll take that batting average for sure, .273. Even the OBP, I would love it to be a little higher, but I'll take that. Like, I'd love for him to just be a double-digit walk percentage guy all of a sudden. That'd be pretty sweet. Don't know if that's going to happen, but the slugging number is ugly. It's very emblematic of the team as a whole. .273, .325, it should then be .500 for Julio after that. Like, he should be putting up 800-plus OPS seasons. Like, he's capable of that. Like, he that should be the benchmark, .500 slugging percentage. Like, a .734 OPS is just not what you want from Julio. Like, he just, that's potentially the best season for 80% of baseball players on earth in Major League Baseball, but him, expectations are higher, and they should be. After all this, he ends up with a 2020 season again. We should care about that. It's rare and it's impressive. It's a little less rare now, but it's still pretty rare. It's like, it's slightly less rare, just a skosh less. He tied A-Rod for most 2020 seasons in franchise history with 3 already. I would put good money he will break that record within the next year or two. 2020, though, both numbers are down from last year. 20 home runs, 24 stolen bases. He went 30-30 last year. Like, his season-long WRC Plus was 116, which, that's a solid number, and again, for a lot of players, that might be a career best. 16% better than league average in that department is great. But for him, we've seen 130-plus from him before, and that's kind of where it needs to be. The 6.2 walk percentage was his lowest in his career, but only by, like, less than a percentage point. His K percentage was his career average, roughly, like, slightly over 25%. I don't need him to strike out less than that. I just don't think it's going to happen. I think the way he approaches the plate, I don't think it's going to be lower than that. Like, if he gets it down to 23, I would be over a full season. I'd be over the moon with that. It's just the walk rate. I mean, I've said it. Everyone has wanted it for years. Like, the walk rate, 6.2 is not great. Like, I would love if that was around 8%. Which in August and September, he was around 22% K and 8% walk. He gives me a full season of that. He's winning the MVP. Like, that's great numbers. Looking at his swing profile, like, just digging a little deeper, not a whole lot changed this season. Like, really, his chase number was, like, literally the same as last year. He did whiff swing and miss slightly more this season. He swung at pitches in the zone more. Felt like he swung at a lot more pitches at, like, the front of the at-bat, like a lot of just 0-0 swings on stuff and just swinging out of his shoes. And, yeah, I mean, I wanted to find something super wrong in his swing profile numbers, but, I mean, he didn't make quite as much contact in the zone as he did last season, but also, again, like I said, he swung more at stuff in the zone too. So I think his zone contact rate went down in accordance to his whiff rate this year, and he just swung at more pitches in the zone. So he just looked lost up there for a lot of the season. I think he lost his way in his head. A lot of non-competitive at-bats, pressed a lot. And then also, you can't talk about his season without talking about the improvement I think he does need in his just, like, general maturity out there, like, in paying attention on the base paths. I think a maturity conversation with Latin players can get down a dicey road as a white man with a baseball podcast. But I'm not one of the bad ones. And I just, like, you could tell, like, there were just points this year where his head just was not there, and whether that was because he was struggling, like probably, but also he's 23. Like, his brain is not fully developed yet. You know, like, I think this is going to come with time, more reps in the bigs. I felt like Justin Turner helped him a lot just as a presence in the clubhouse to talk to after they traded for him. Like, I think that stuff will come as he just plays more. But it's no secret, he gave up some runs on the bases this year, and he shouldn't do that. He's too good for that. He's too good to toot Bland as much as he did. And that was a theme with the whole team this year. And maybe that was Scott Servais and the rest of the coaches kind of losing the guys there in the middle of the season. Whatever it was, I mean, it was definitely some maturity stuff that he'll need to work on more, just like keeping his head in the game and just kind of focusing on what he can do best. Not like he shouldn't play with the fire that he does. Like, that's not what I'm saying, but he toot Bland quite a bit this year. Really, really unfortunate from a guy who should be elite on the base path. All in all, really, at the plate, not a great season from him. There was plenty of missed opportunities, I think, is what is the issue here. And he read the power number was non-existent for half the year, more than half the year, and that really sucked. So even as I ramble on here, I'm going to talk about his defense in a second, but even in a mediocre season, he still put up the second most WAR on the team from a position player with 3.8 Fangraphs WAR. Went 20-20 again and cut the K rate in those final couple months. Just, it should tell you, like, we should criticize him, but his floor is so high. It's kind of like Cal Raleigh has put up a lot of WAR this year, and because that's just kind of the nature of the position too. Like, catchers, shortstops, and center fielders, second baseman to a lesser degree, but a little bit, just get so many more reps than the other positions that their WAR will trend higher, which is why I like to just look at catchers specifically in the realm of catchers. But center field, he plays a great center field and he steals bases. And if he's even like a 100 WRC plus guy for a full season, that's like a 3 WAR benchmark, which is great, but we just know what he can do, and he can do better than that. I could go on, but being a league average bat for 3 months and then like a great bat for the next 3 months is kind of just what his season was. He put up 8 outs above average in center field this year, according to Baseball Savant, aka StatCast. Not quite as high as his numbers last year, but defensive numbers can really fluctuate a good amount season to season. Lots of other factors that go into that every year. And then not the season we expected, still contributed probably more positively than negatively overall after those first few months. And I didn't even really talk about the ankle injury. Like, he was, felt like he was just starting to get going at the plate. And then just bam, he slams into the wall. The ankle injury, he came back soon, and it was clearly still hurting him too. So that definitely derailed both his momentum and his overall potential production for a couple weeks there. I mean, I was surprised. I think everyone was. His ankles didn't just snap off. Like, we're lucky it was, and he's lucky it was just a relatively minor injury. It could have been like a broken ankle. But that was a gut punch for him for sure. It felt like he was just starting to hit the ball hard, and then he hurt his ankle. It has another couple weeks in no slugging purgatory. But what we need for him to do, and this isn't my idea, this came up on the Cespedes Family Barbecue, and I don't remember which one of those fellows said it, but we need him to play winter ball in Lidom, the Dominican Winter Ball League. So once April hits, he'll be in midseason form. Like, if he just plays baseball all winter, he'll be in like July form by the time spring training comes around. So I think that's the solution here. And then we'll kick off the 2025 season, and he'll win the MVP, and the Mariners will win the AL West. That'll happen. It'll happen. Just mark it down. I'm done talking about Julio. Let's move on to the other good players on this team. And really, wow, I'm looking at the time. Not going to talk about the bad guys a lot. I'm just going to say they were bad. I don't want to dwell on the bad. But the next guy on this list is the monkey man himself, the man who owns two monkeys, Victor Robles. I mean, holy shit. Like, I want to write him a love poem for what he did to my heart this season and the hearts of all Mariners fans. His entire tenure with the Mariners this year felt so surreal, and it still does. It still feels like that didn't happen. Like, it felt like it was a fever dream. He was literally the perfect candidate for like a couple week stint and then subsequent DFA with the Mariners in the middle of the year. Julio just got hurt. He just hurt his ankle on the IL, and then Robles was just released by the Nationals, and so the Mariners brought him in to play center field. Great move. I mean, Robles, even baseball casuals might have recognized his name because he was a former top prospect in baseball. For like three straight years, he was the Nationals' number one prospect, over Juan Soto, I might add, and made his debut and was one of the youngest players to ever make it to the bigs. His bat just never worked out prior to this season with the Mariners. His bat just never worked out. His defense was what was making him get played. Like, his center field defense was gold glove quality. It still is really, really productive. And so he was just the perfect candidate for Jerry DePoto, former top prospect, can play a good center field. And that's all the M's really needed while Julio was gone. Like, you're not just going to go get like a good center field production from a rental at all in the middle of the season. Even at the deadline, it's kind of far-fetched to imagine like Luis Robert would have been the guy at the deadline if this was around the same time. All you can really ask is just, you maybe get a guy who can play good defense. Like, you get like a Christian Pache or Kevin Pillar or something, like someone who can just play good center field defense. You got no expectations for them at the plate. And Victor Robles was that. For the league minimum, great. That's perfect. That's all they really needed. But holy man, it turned into so much more than that, and turned into a wonderful little vignette in this larger disappointing Mariners season. He was unreal. Like, he was unreal for the Mariners. And how he was playing the game was amazing. He was great at the plate, in the dugout, in the field, in interviews. He forced Seattle to fall in love with him immediately. And they paid him for it. They paid him to stay around for at least the next 2 years. He was one of the best hitters in baseball from June until the end of the season. He hit 120, 281, 120 for the Nats in 14 games. Goes to the Mariners, and he hits 328, 393, 467 in 77 games, an 860 OPS, and 30 stolen bases, 154 WRC plus in a Mariners uniform. Unreal. Surreal experience. Just every game I kept saying, you can't keep getting away with this, and he just kept doing it. And he really hit the ball hard in June. Like, he hit the ground running and was hitting the ball hard, like harder than he ever has. And that has been the issue with him. He's never been like a super big strikeout guy. Like, his contact is fine, and his just like ability to put bat to the ball is fine. He just couldn't hit the ball hard, like, at all, not in the slightest. He was consistently like among the lowest average exit velocity hitters in baseball since he's been playing. I will say, and maybe we'll do a pod on this in the offseason of what to expect from him next year, but after June, his hard hit numbers were really not good. I'll say that. But really, we're talking about mostly positives here. He put up 3.2 Fangraphs WAR in 77 games for the Mariners. Like, hitters never do this. They never do this. This literally never happens. Hitters don't just come to Seattle and hit better. It just doesn't happen. Like, Nelson Cruz did it. I've talked about that. That still doesn't make sense to me. I still stand and will die on the hill that Nelson Cruz's tenure in Seattle alone should get him into the Hall of Fame. But Victor Robles did it. It's such a shame that this team missed the playoffs for so many reasons. Obviously, everyone would love to make the playoffs, but I think Robles would have been a main character in October. Like, absolutely. Can you imagine him in October with the Mariners? Insane. It would have been awesome. He was kind of the perfect change of scenery guy. Like, it felt like getting out of DC was just the best thing for him. But for him, it was like, man, if he can just slug above 300, that might be good. But nope. 467. If he was even league average and played good center field defense, so helpful. But no, he was so much better than that. 2024 Victor Robles will never be forgotten. I will tell my grandkids about this. I swear to God, I'll never forget his monkeys, his intro Instagram post that he had on his story, his bunting, his incessant bunting, his stealing third base antics. I've talked about the two plans he had at the end of the year. Those weren't great, but I felt like he just could not resist an opportunity to try to steal third base. And he was pretty damn effective at it too. What a guy. I'm so glad he's going to be on the team next year. I have legitimately no clue what he's going to do next year, production-wise. No idea, but I'm not going to think about that right now. He was amazing. I love him. Everyone loves him. But I got to keep going. Salute to you, Victor Robles. Thank you so much for providing light in an otherwise very dark season. And we'll get to the fourth place position in Mariners position player F4 in 2024. Some of you might know who this is. Can you guess? If you guessed the super utility man with massive arms, you'd be correct. It's Dylan Moore, fourth in position player F4 and finalist for the utility man gold glove, which he should win, which would be awesome. I love Dylan Moore. This was a genuinely great year from Dylan Moore. The only problem, I think, is that he played a little too much, and that's not entirely his fault. He ended up slashing 201, 320, 367. That's not amazing. 12% walk rate, great. 28% K rate, not great. 10 dingers, 32 stolen bases, 105 WRC+, which a lot of that definitely can be attributed to the walk rate and definitely his base running. 2.4 F4. And that's in 135 games, 441 plate appearances. Like, from a super utility guy, that is a great season. Great season. He just ended up starting, and I shouldn't say he ended up playing too much. He started too many games. Like, he was in the starting lineup a little too much. He filled in and took a lot of shortstop reps when JP was hurt. Some of the him playing too much was just came out of necessity because of injuries. Team totally could have, and maybe should have, traded for a rental in shortstop instead of rolling in with Dylan Moore out there every day, like Paul DeJong type. But hey, I don't run the team. It's really great he can play shortstop at all. He's not a very good defender over there, but he's not expected to be. I mean, there's not very many good defensive shortstops in the world to begin with, so it's great he can even play shortstop, like, somewhat effectively. But where he played this year, he ended up playing, starting. I'll do starting and then appeared in. He ended up starting in 4 games at first base, 24 at second base, 27 at third base, 38 at shortstop, 15 in left field, and 4 in right field. That is amazing. And that's just starts. So he appeared in, which is just he played at least a third of an inning there at some point in some game during this year. He appeared at first base 11 games at first base, 37 at second base, 45 at third base, 49 at shortstop, 22 in left field, 5 in right field, and then he appeared in center field once this year too. It's just, this is a phenomenal year for a utility man like Dylan Moore, who you're paying like $3 million a year. Like, 2.4 F4 for a guy who's supposed to come off the bench. Like, that's so solid. And he, like, don't get it twisted. Like, the slash line is not amazing, but that is a great season from Dylan Moore. Like, prior to 2024 as well, this was fun. There have only been 15 players in Mariners history that have stolen 30-plus bags in a single season. After 2024, Victor Robles and Dylan Moore are now on that list and made it 17 players who've done that in Mariners history. And both of those guys didn't play like a full season with the Mariners and still stole 30 plus bags. They are two of four Mariners ever to steal 30 plus in 450 play appearances or less. Julio Cruz did that twice and Ricky Henderson once. And Robles and Julio Cruz are the only ones to ever do it in less than 300. Another little fun Victor Robles stat. But great year from Dylan Moore. Ended up just starting too many games. But still, that is just a great, great year. That's so much more than you can ask for from a utility guy. And that's kind of perfect. That's kind of exactly what you want. He appeared in a bunch of different positions, every position except for pitcher and catcher, which is expected. And that is exactly what you want. Great. I don't have a whole lot else to say about Dylan Moore. I mean, he'll strike out a lot, but largely I thought he put together good plate appearances for most of this year and was available all the time. And that is great. And I don't have a whole lot else to say about Dylan Moore other than great season. Hope he wins the Gold Glove for utility, man. So shout out to Big Arms Dylan Moore. And we'll move down the line. It is time. It's time to talk about the best compact fridge with legs I've ever seen, Luke Raley. Now, I talked about this, when did I talk about this? Probably September sometime. Jerry nailed this trade. I remember liking this trade when it happened. It made sense at the time. They really needed a left-handed hitting outfielder who wasn't named Dominic Canzone. And I would have lumped Jarrett Kelenic in too if they hadn't been traded prior, I believe, to this. I just wholly did not believe in either one of those guys to be the full-time lefty outfielder. So I really liked that because he had reverse splits last year. He put up a career year, 120 games-ish for the Rays. Crushed right-handed pitching. Looked just solid all around. Didn't quite play a full year, but that's just the nature of that Rays team. They platooned him a lot, and for good reason. He had 129 WRC plus last season, 406 play appearances, with 19 home runs and 14 stolen bases. Struck out a decent amount, which is why that was one of the funny things about this trade. This was not a cutting down on strikeouts trade. But that's just such a solid year, and they traded for that, and only gave up Jose Caballero, who they didn't. They definitely could have used, but then they got Polanco, so it made sense in the context of the offseason, and I was happy with that, because they didn't necessarily need a guy like Caballero on the team. They needed Luke Raley more than they needed Caballero, although Caballero would have been helpful. It was a deal that fit the needs of both teams. My only reservation I did have about this trade is the 129 WRC plus number that he put up. I didn't think he was going to be able to do that again, to be quite honest with you. That was my big concern, because I thought they were just going to have to play him more against left-handed pitching than the Rays did last year. The Rays had the luxury of not having to do that much in 2023 because it seemed like they were going to platoon him with Mitch Haniger, and I wasn't a fan of that and didn't believe in Mitch Haniger, and so I thought Luke Raley was going to play a little bit more. And that came true, but he put up the same numbers almost. He had a phenomenal year for the Mariners. That ended up being true, but it didn't matter. My doubts of that number, 129 WRC plus, were literally proven wrong by the exact same number. In 2024, playing after the first month or two of the season, playing a full-time corner outfield role for the most part, filling in at first base a lot in the second half, he put 137 games this year, 455 plate appearances, and put up the same WRC plus, 129. He had 22 home runs. He had 11 stolen bases. Also just fast on the base path. I'm glad everyone got to see how fast that guy is. He cut his K rate by almost 2%. Walked a little bit less, but not a significant amount less. Overall, great season. 2.3 F4 from a guy who wasn't a regular until halfway through the year is really solid. And That was my biggest concern heading into the year, was the corner outfield spots by far. I guess the corners in general, but the corner outfield is a little bit more worried about. And Raley wasn't a starter initially, right? So if you recall, he didn't start on opening day. It was Canzone in left field, Julio in center, and Haniger in right field. Looking back, that's kind of ridiculous. I think the plan, obviously, was to play Canzone and hopefully further his development along, and we just kind of know how that went, and then try to do a platoon type thing with Haniger, really. Probably try to mix and match like Dylan Moore and Haniger in the corners with Raley and Canzone as well. Try to do that as effectively as possible. I mentioned already I was super skeptical of Haniger coming into the year, and I was correct. Not rocket science again to make that prediction, but as the year went on, Luke Raley kept proving that he just kind of should have been thrust into a full-time role. Eventually he was. He was a full-time guy. Helped that they shipped Ty France out, and he took some first base reps, but he still ended up having pretty heavy platoon splits. He crushed right-handed pitching again, and not left-handed pitching at all. There was like a 250 OPS point difference there between his splits, and he chased less than he did last season. That was pretty reflective in that couple percentage point drop in the K rate. And he did the same thing he did well last year. Besides the fact that he crushed right-handed pitching, he crushed the fastball again, which is a very good thing to do, in my opinion. He had a lot of barrels this year, a little bit more than last year, just a solid hitter. He wasn't amazing defensively. That wasn't really expected of him. And I don't care like a whole lot about corner outfield defense unless you're just Raul Ibanez, Jesse Winker in 22 type bad. And he wasn't that bad, so that was good. Definitely ended up playing more first base than I think anyone probably expected when they acquired him, but obviously it fit the need of the team at the time. It was huge that he could play first base after France departed, and then it gave them the freedom to like continue playing Robles and then acquire Randy and even like Justin Turner, because you have splits there. The fact that he could play first offered them a lot of positional flexibility around the deadline and in the middle of the year. I think the best part of Luke Raley's year was Dave Sims just could not help himself at all, calling him like a big boy. Anytime Luke Raley got like an extra base hit or was rounding the bases in some way or stole a base, he'd say something like, oh, the big fella, the stocky fella, and like, oh, the speed for that frame. Like, it's fair. Like, it's very fair. Just the way Dave Sims talked about him, I loved it all year. It was so funny. It was awesome to see fans realize how fast he is, despite the way he looks. It's kind of Mike Trout-esque. He's not quite as built, and no one quite has the neck that Mike Trout has. But just like faster than the build looks, like kind of like a tight end kind of deal. He really charmed the fan base as the season went on. He struggled at times, but especially towards the end of the year, he had some really big hits as they were going for a playoff spot. Had super productive August and September, like very reflective of the offense as a whole. Had some very fun base running at times, had some fun bunts. It seemed like he was always the first guy to celebrate a walk-off hit this season. I don't have a whole lot else to say about him other than just like I'm excited to have him back next season. And like I said, positional flexibility. The fact that he's a left-handed hitter and can play first base and the corners is so helpful when you potentially have an opening day outfield of Victor Robles, Julio Rodriguez, and Randy Rosarena. Luke Raley, we know, crushes right-handed pitching, so maybe we see a corner outfield platoon with Robles and Raley for a good part of next year, and then also it depends on what they want to do at first base. I imagine, since they probably won't like acquire Pete Alonso or even trade for any first baseman, but I feel like he's going to play a lot of first base next year, which is good. That also hides any defensive flaws he might have in the outfield, so that is super helpful, and just a solid, solid season from Luke Raley. Really, really impressed me as the year went on. And this was a trade that, again, I think Jerry absolutely nailed. So I think that that matters for something. And now we're going to get into the not so good. Those were all the good hitters. Those were all the guys I deemed good this season. And now the other two who were good, I'm going to Randy and Justin Turner, the deadline bats, they were also good. I talked about them a lot towards the end of the season. Both put up great numbers. Like they both, I'm not going to talk about them much because I talked about them a lot the past, like leading up to the end of the season. But they were in the good category. They just like didn't have as many counting stats with the team, but they were still about as good as you could ask for deadline acquisitions. Like Randy had a 122 WRC plus in 54 games. Justin Turner had a 126 WRC plus in 48 games. Both did about as expected as their player profiles. Like they didn't necessarily underperform, or I think Randy was right on basically. Justin Turner definitely performed better than I expected. Like that's 126 WRC plus is phenomenal for him. Oldest position player in the league, I believe. And I know the fans want him back. I see literally no downside in offering him a 1 year, $7 million, $8 million, whatever contract. Any serious team would do that again because he was so impactful to the team and the clubhouse, it seems like, last year. And he's an old veteran. If he just absolutely craters and falls off a cliff production-wise next season, you just DFA him and release him. And you're losing, what, $7 million? Like, a serious team would he be able to handle that. But, again, they're not a serious team. So we'll see what they do. It's kind of like, I was pretty mad they didn't bring back Carlos Santana. And I think a lot of people were after 2022. Made no sense to me. Why not? Like these 1 year veterans, I never see any downside for this. And he's not taking up any space. Like I don't know internally how they feel about Tyler Locklear at first base. But what he showed this year is not amazing. And I think you probably are okay starting Locklear in AAA and starting Justin Turner and Luke Raley at first base DHE next year. So we'll see what they do. I hope they bring him back, but he was a great acquisition. Shout out to Jerry and the team for that one and Randy. But that's all I'm going to talk about with them. I don't want to get too in the weeds. I'll talk about Randy especially a lot more as we head into like next season. We'll start with, it's the start of the mediocre. I think I don't want to call his season bad because it wasn't bad. It wasn't amazing. So mid, we'll just call it mid. And this is the only one in this category. Let me be clear. And it is Josh Rojas. Somehow, not a Gold Glove finalist at third base in the American League. That was where most of his value came from this year. So it's kind of insane that he's not a finalist. I don't know what those people look at. Juan Soto was a finalist for right field, which is crazy. It's clear they don't care about outs above average. Do they look at defensive runs saved or like UZR or anything else? Or just they go off vibes? Because I think Ernie Clement was one of the finalists at third base this season. I think Ernie Clement played maybe half a season and Josh Rojas played 143 games of Gold Glove caliber defense. Shout out to Perry Hill. I don't know. But Josh Rojas, he was one of the best hitters on the planet in April, which was very fun, but ended up with a season that was like pretty predictable from him. 91 WRC plus, that's not good. But he's in the mediocre category, and I wrote this down because he might win Gold Glove at third base. Obviously, he's not going to. He put up 1.9 F4 in 143 games. That's like right where I've talked about this. Right where I want a mediocre player to be is two wins above replacement. That's kind of right in that sweet spot where, yeah, that's useful to a team. Shouldn't be one of your main hitters, but that's useful. Similar to what we saw from Eugenio after joining the Mariners, his jump at third base this season defensively was awesome. Like Perry Hill, please stay with the team. Don't retire or leave. Like you're a wizard, dude. It's kind of insane. I think the same thing happened here to Rojas as Dylan Moore, where I'm like fine with this season. It's not amazing. Dylan Moore had a better year, but I think Josh Rojas, he just played too many games. He was a fantastic third baseman. Third baseman? Yeah, I'll run with that. That doesn't provide me like enough value to play every day. Like, it was great that he did that, and it definitely made me feel better about seeing him in the lineup basically every day, but that is like, from a team that wants to contend, that is something that needs to be considered on serious. The plan, if you recall, was in Luis Urias, Josh Rojas platoon at third base, which was just the most bullshit DePoto idea ever. And wow, surprise, surprise, didn't work out. I think Rojas this season and maybe even next season would be like kind of your perfect left-handed hitting utility infielder who can play the corner outfield in a pinch. He and Dylan Moore would complement each other perfectly in those roles. On like a serious contending baseball team, I think the ideal role is backup second base and third base, and sparingly corner outfield, predominantly against right-handed pitching. That's it. But 2024 Mariners were not a serious contending baseball team, so he played just too much, diluted his value probably a little bit. Not going to get a gold glove too, which sucks. So just kind of a disappointing season. It stings even more considering what Eugenio did with the Diamondbacks this season. But I've said this a lot and I'll continue to say it. I panned that trade when it happened, wasn't a fan, but if Eugenio was on the 2024 Mariners, he wouldn't have put up those numbers at all. If he was in Seattle this season, he probably would have continued his downward spiral that we kind of saw last year developing. So I'm glad he went somewhere else and put up great numbers. So yeah, Josh Rojas, I think he deserves to be in the mediocre category. I mean, within 10% of league average at the plate-ish, like Cade, slightly lower than league average, drew a decent amount of walks, had some timely hits. He had 10 stolen bases. Again, played gold glove defense, caliber defense. And I think that's fine. Again, played too much for his own good. We'll see what they end up doing with him. He might catch a non-tender. I'm unsure about what they're going to do with him. Is that even his contract? I could be completely talking about out of my ass here, but I might have a non-tendering podcast to talk about. But yeah, Josh Rojas, fine. Fine season. And now we'll get into the bad. And the first guy I'm going to start with disappoints me greatly. J.P. Crawford. Just so unfortunate his year. It felt like it really never got off the ground at all. But he ended up playing 105 games. Did you think that he played 105 games? It feels like he played 60 this year. 105, maybe it's just because... No, I don't know. I don't know why I think that. I felt like he didn't play at all this year. Like, 105 is a lot more than I expected. 451 play appearances, that's damn near a full sample size I can take data from. Like, that's so much more than I expected him playing. Just disappointing. Coming off a career year at the plate, I don't know if anyone expected him to put up quite the numbers. I was a little skeptical about like him reproducing that, but I think the improvements were repeatable and like tangible. Like, he continued being one of the better guys in the league at just laying off balls. He still was good at that this year when he played. Like, he had a 11.5% walk rate. That's really solid. And he just crushed fastballs in the middle of the plate last year, which is good. It's a good thing to do. That's a good strategy. His swing was a little different. Felt like it had a lot more torque on it. Hit for so much more power than he ever has last year. And this year, nothing was there. Nothing was really there. He struck out 22.6% of the time. That's like, you know, fine. 9 home runs, 5 stolen bases. Like, he put up 1.6 F4 in those 105 games. All of that really coming from defense. He was really solid defensively when he played this year, which was a welcome addition? No. Event? No. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. Like I said, his season just never took lift off. He had a really tough start to the year, at the plate, and then he hurt his oblique in April. And while rehabbing in Tacoma in mid-May, he was finally close to getting back. He gets hit by a pitch in the hand, delays his comeback, and he finally comes back at the end of May. And then he's like fine at the plate in July. He's not great. He's not terrible. And then he gets hit in the hand and fractures his pinky and misses 5 weeks. And then he's back for basically the full month of September, and he's terrible. He was so bad. And they can't not play him. He is your shortstop. He is currently your franchise shortstop. He's earned that. You couldn't not play him down the stretch. But he was just terrible. In the midst of the offense being great, he really was not good. He looked lost at the plate. All of September, he looked very, very lost. Like, just non-competitive at bats. He drew less walks, too. I felt like he was pressing and just hacking. He was comfortably their worst hitting regular in the month of September. I mean, Josh Rojas was worse than him, but played slightly less. So, just a disappointing season. Something, they needed him this year. They needed him like they needed him last year when Julio wasn't quite producing, but it just wasn't there, and then injuries just derailed everything. And obliques are tricky. The fact that he was really bad to start the year, I'm willing to chalk up to just sample size, even though it didn't look good. And then hurting your oblique, who knows? He came back in like a month, but obliques in baseball, there's so much twisting involved in hitting and a shortstop for that matter, that maybe it bothered him all year. And then just getting a broken pinky sucks, and just obviously you can't hit, you can't grip a bat for a long time. Just sucks. Just a bad season. I don't even want to keep talking about it. It was just not a good year from him, and they really needed it. I need a bounce back year from him next year more than I need air. But I'm going to move on because I have to talk about Jorge Polanco and Mitch Garver. I'll throw them both in here because why not? These ones hurt. They hurt real bad. This is part of what cratered the Mariners season, is these two guys I shouldn't even say it wasn't expected. This is always a thing when you acquire any player that has a good track record. There's always, for any team, I should say, like baseball, sometimes guys just stop being good. But for the Mariners, it's what we're known for. Is shipping out guys and having them be awesome and getting guys with great career track records and them just sucking. Straight up, they were awful. Polanco, you look at his season, 114 games, 453 plate appearances, 16 home runs, 45 RBIs, 4 stolen bases. He walked about 10% of the time, struck out a lot, 29% almost, 96 WRC plus, 0.5 F4. Not good. Defensively, not good. That is such a mediocre year. Not a good year. But especially for Jorge Polanco, who has just been a super solid vet for most of his career with the Twins. When they acquired Jorge Polanco, I talked about the rising K rate, but I talked about it not really worrying me because it came subsequently with a rise in power. He had been hitting a lot more home runs, and that made sense in the context of the Mariners because, like I've said, T-Mobile is not it's a bad place to hit, but home runs, it's not that bad. Like, guys can hit a lot of home runs at T-Mobile Park. It's all the other hits that are really awful. And so that was kind of encouraged. I was like, it kind of plays into the ballpark a little bit. He can play second base. And then the year started, and it was like, oh God, we just went through this with Colton Wong. It's happening again, isn't it? And it didn't happen to the extent of Colton Wong. Jorge Polanco turned it around a little bit as the year went on, but it was just like, is it really happening again? And the second base position has been cursed since Cano got traded. He was so bad to start the year. And just looking at, like, taking some dates here. So he had a 96 WRC plus the whole year, right? From June until the end of the year, he had a 100 WRC plus. He was just a completely league average hitter from June till the end of the year. What's really carrying that is his month of July, he was great. He was great in the month of July. He had 5 home runs. He hit 241, 315, 468, had a 127 WRC plus, 0.4 F4 in the month of July. His number on the year was 0.5. I don't even know. He just looked terrible. There's a lot of contributing factors here that I don't really want to dwell on. Like, I could really go into Savant and break it down. And maybe I will if they pick up his option. But everything was bad. He didn't hit for as much power. He just didn't do anything as well as he has done in his career. Which, are we that surprised he came to the Mariners? Like, no. But God, it would have been nice if he was good all year. Had like a 120 WRC plus consistently the whole year. Would have been great. He just got surgery on his knee, which we didn't not know about. I think the severity was in question. But he missed a decent amount of time this year. Like, he only played 114 games. But we knew he was kind of playing through a knee injury all year. Knew that was affecting him. So, I mean, that is a contributing factor. The big question here is that option that I talked about. So there's a club option for $12 million next season. And I might get into this in more depth in the coming weeks. I need to look up when the threshold is for them to pick that up or decline it. I'm in the camp that it's $12 million, and so they're just going to decline it and try to figure it out at second base. I mean, if they really think Polanco is going to be like this type of hitter, like just a more closer to league average hitter next year, paying him $12 million doesn't make sense. And like, they can just play Ryan Bliss there. And while Ryan Bliss might not next season or ever be a good hitter in Major League Baseball, he looked like he was good defensively over there and was very fast and could steal bases. And so that can provide you more value than hoping Jorge Polanco can put it together. But $12 million for what the alternative is, there's just not a whole lot of second base options out there, in-house or like free agency or trade. Are the Rays looking to trade Brandon Lau? He seems like the perfect candidate to come to the Mariners and absolutely have a career worst year. And I can't even think of who might be available for free agency. Like, Willy Adames is a shortstop. Like, I don't think he's going to agree to play second base anywhere. So I don't know what they do. Because you can look at it like he just had surgery and he's, what, 30, 31? Why is his age? He's 31. So he'll turn 32 next July. Coming off a career worst year. The option is $12 million. He just got surgery. You can look at that. Like, why would they pick up the option? Or you can look at it on the flip side. Look at his career track record. Pick up the option because he was playing injured this year. That knee should be healthy after his surgery going into next year. And you just bank on a bounce back and you work with him in the offseason. I see the merit for both sides of that, to be quite honest with you. But I lean that they won't pick it up because they're cheap as fuck. So we'll see. And then Mitch Garver, even worse. Mitch Garver, if it weren't for Mitch Haniger, would have been the absolute worst hitter on this team this year. Worst player on this team. Just so disappointing. I was so bullish on this acquisition. It made so much sense. It made so much sense. They needed a DH. Badly, a full-time DH. You sign Garver to a two-year, $24 million deal. That's like, for a guy that has done what he's done in his career, that's just a great contract. Like, everyone, I didn't see anyone saying like overpaid. Oh, that's a terrible contract. That's a really solid contract for a guy that should be a good full-time DH hitter. And he was so bad. He came to the Mariners, and the biggest concern was health by far. It was like last year he had a career year at the plate, but only played 87 games because he wasn't healthy. He was playing backup catcher too. So the idea was hopefully you play him at full-time DH, which he had DH'd a lot in his career up until this point, and he'll stay healthier. And he ended up playing 114 games this year, 430 plate appearances. If you told me he would have had 430 plate appearances at the start of the year and was healthy, I would have been over the moon. I would have been like, oh, that's great. You probably had like 120 WRC plus. That's awesome. He did not. He was so bad. He had 15 home runs, 51 RBIs. He walked 12.3% of the time. That was the big thing. It was like, oh, you're cutting down on strikeouts? Oh, you're getting a guy who's probably going to walk 13% of the time and strike out 23. That's great. He walked 12.3. That's great. He did that. That was fine. That was expected of him. He struck out damn near 31% of the time. I want the batter's eye in Seattle to be investigated extensively this offseason. I demand it. I don't know if Mitch Garver just completely lost it or not. You know, I have no idea if he just lost it and the batter's eye have nothing to do with it. We'll never know. I just demand the batter's eye is someone needs to look into it. It's just so bad. 88 WRC plus from your what was supposed to be the full-time DH, and ended up just no one wanted to see him in the lineup in September. Everyone was just kind of done. And he seems like such a good dude. I feel so bad for him. He'll be back with the team next year, whether they like it or not. I don't think they're just going to punt on him, which I think they should do with Mitch Haniger. But I think he'll be back. I hope maybe he transitions into a platoon role with like Luke Reilly at DH. He's supposed to crush lefties too. And he wasn't a slouch against righties, but he was supposed to absolutely crush lefties. And he didn't do much. Like he didn't do much at all. Did he even crush lefties? I'm looking at his splits right now. No, he didn't. He really didn't. And he ended up playing 25 games at catcher. He ended up playing a lot more catcher because Sebi Saval was so bad. So he ended up being the full-time backup catcher way more. I think I set the over-under at like 10 games because I just thought Sebi was going to be like a fine backup catcher most of the year. And that was like, I remember Scott Service saying that was like supposed to, him catching more was supposed to like get him back in the rhythm, which I don't disagree with. That's a totally baseball thing, but that didn't happen. I don't want to keep talking about it. Was just that is so disappointing to a signing and a trade that I think most people in Mariners land and MLB land were like, yeah, that's great, that those are two great additions and so appropriate of them to just be bad. So the last really bad player, and then there's a lot of guys who got barely any playing time with the team this year that I'll mention, but it's Mitch Haniger, man. 82 WRC plus. He slashed 205. Oh, Mitch Garver, he batted 171, by the way. That's not good. Mitch Haniger, 205, above the Mendoza line. Hang the banner. 284 OBP, 325 slug. 29.4% K rate, 9.6% walk rate, hit 11 home runs, 41 RBIs, which I feel like all of those came in April. If you don't know his WAR, what do you think his F WAR was? Wrong. It was lower than that. It was -0.7. Terrible in the field, terrible at the plate. I love Mitch Haniger. I really do. He played 117 games, 408 play appearances. As I said at the top of the show, playing both Mitches that many times is what took down their season. And I don't necessarily blame them for the Mitch Garver. I blame them for Mitch Haniger. Who could have seen this coming? everyone with a brain could have seen this coming. It was great to see him back in a Mariners uniform. This was the ultimate fan service move. And that was the only nice thing about his season, was just seeing him back playing in Seattle. You know? I really love the man, but Jesus. So bad. And the worst part is his contract does not expire this season. He is set to make $17.5 million next year. He made 16 this year. And that's a $14.5 million luxury tax hit for the Mariners, which they're not going to bother to reach, even come close to that threshold, so it doesn't matter. And it's a player option. Like, he's going to pick that up. If he denies it, there's some funny business. There's some under the table cash going, which genuinely I'd be in support of. John Stanton, run him $17.5 million through like an offshore account, and then just have Mitch decline the option and become like a coach or something. That would be the best case scenario here. Because for a team that is supposedly hurting for cash, that's a lot of money to play someone who shouldn't be on your baseball team. So my suggestion is to cut your losses and just get rid of him. I don't even think it's worth having him on the opening day roster, to be quite honest with you. Eat the money, which they don't want. I know they don't want to do. I don't think you can move him at all. He was kind of moved as a salary piece to begin with, and then DePoto used those pieces to trade for Polanco. If Polanco was amazing, I'd feel a little bit less bad about this production for Mitch Haniger, because he was kind of just a cog in multiple trade ideas from DePoto. But I just don't. I don't need to see him on the team next year at all, really. And that's the end of the good and bad players. Like Ty France, he played half a season. Obviously, we know he wasn't where we needed him to be. Went to the Reds. And then there's a bunch of other guys on here that like played like barely. Like Samad Taylor has 5 plate appearances. Cade Marlowe has 9. Sam Haggerty was 16 and got hurt, which sucks for him. Jason Vossler got 30 plate appearances. That's ugly. Sebby Savala got 40 and was one of the worst hitters I've ever seen. Jonathan Clase wasn't great. Got dealt for a reliever that didn't work out. Tyler Locklear, I don't know about him. Really, I have no idea. Like he'll be in spring training. We'll see. I hope he makes some strides. I think there's definitely something there. I think most scouts that I've seen evaluate him as like a future value 45 guy, which is basically just a kind of replacement level Major League Baseball player. He looked so overmatched at the plate. Like, it was very clear he was not ready to face Major League pitching. Ryan Bliss had 71 plate appearances. He had that series in Miami, but that was about it. He's an interesting player to have. I think he's a helpful player to have in AAA to call up. I don't know. He's also similar to Locklear. I think scouts see him as also a future value 45 guy. So I don't know about that. Luis Urias, ugh. I liked acquiring him as a potential just bounce back guy, because he has been good before, but that didn't work out. Leo Rivas had his moments, you know. He filled in for JP a little bit and had a couple clutch hits there, but overall just does not look like a very good hitter. Dominic Canzone is the last guy here that got a plate appearance for this team. And just kind of a baffling player, really. I don't know where I'm at with him at all. He can really hit the ball hard. Like, he can really hit a dinger. But the defense, I think, needs to be improved a little bit. And it's a lot of whiff and a lot of hitting fastballs. Like, he had his moments early in the season. And then I think guys and teams learn to just, hey, let's just not ever throw him a four-seam fastball ever again. And he just couldn't really deal with that. So if he figures that out, he has the raw power to put up like big power numbers in the corners. Like, ceiling, I think, is actually decently high. Like, he could be like a three true outcome corner outfielder. Like, he could just, like, he walked 10% of the time this year, struck out 27, hit 8 home runs and 180 play appearances. And some of those were so impressive. But it just didn't do it consistently enough to remain on the team. And Luke Raley just took the spot as the left-handed hitting outfielder. So we'll see where we're at with him, but I'm calling it. That was a long podcast, but I'm glad I could take a look at this offense. Thank you for listening this far. If you're still listening, I love you very much. I appreciate it. And that was 2024 Mariners offense in an hour and a half and some change. So I'll be back later this week to examine a better part of the 2024 Mariners, the pitching staff. But thank you all for listening. Again, look out for that next podcast later in the week. Appreciate the listen. Thank you so much. Hope you have a good rest of your week, and go the good Mariners hitters. Am I right?